And it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And let's start off with our announcements. I do recommend that you have a pencil and paper handy. That way, if there's something that you hear that you want to remember, some detail, some web page, some location, something, you might want to be able to write it down. Anyway, if you want to go to the 2013 Earth First Round River Rendezvous in North Carolina, you better be on the road. Starts July 1st. That's next Monday. It's the annual gathering of the Earth First movement. The week-long campout attracts several hundred Earth Firsters from around the world. And Croatan Earth First will be hosting this year's rendezvous in central North Carolina. If you want to find out where it is, go to 2013summerrondy.wordpress.com. That's 2013summerrondy, R-O-N-D-Y, .wordpress.com. And hope you folks have a good time out there. Hope it doesn't get too wet. There's a lot of water headed towards North Carolina, I'm afraid. Up here in Northern California, police have cut off a Willits protester from food and water, but not for long. Last Saturday evening, around 45 supporters of Red Tail Hawk's occupation of a wick drain stitching machine converged on the site of in what was precious wetlands in the path of Caltrans's Willits Bypass Freeway project. Supporters walked into the site unopposed until they reached California Highway Patrol squad cars, when two officers emerged and tried to call a halt to the march. Supporters from Willits, Ukiah, and beyond proceeded onto the stitcher, in which Red Tail Hawk is perched on a small board up in the air. When he lowered a supply rope, the supporters tried to attach bundles of food and water. However, CHP officers repelled the attempts three different times and wound up cutting the rope. With press on hand, protesters quietly sat and reasoned with the officers to allow resupply to Red-Tailed Hawk, who had no food or water, and no food at that time and very little water left. The officers refused, and also refused to reveal whether they were under orders to starve him until he died or descended. However, yesterday, a supply of food and water was taken in by an Earth First activist and hoisted up to Red Tail Hawk's perch. Until that resupply, he had been out of food and water for 4 days. And to keep track of all this, go to www.earthfirstnews.wordpress.com. And Navajos have launched direct action against Big Coal in this story by Sarah Lazar of Common Dreams, and you can also find this on the Earth First Newswire. Navajo Nation members launched a creative direct action recently to protest the massive coal-fueled power plant that cuts through their Scottsdale, Arizona land. After a winding march, approximately 60 demonstrators used a massive solar-powered truck to pump water from the critical Central Arizona Project Canal into barrels for delivery to the reservation. Flanked by supporters from across the United States, tribal members created a living example of what a Navajo-led transition away from coal towards solar power in the region could look like. Participants waved colorful banners and signs declaring, "Power without pollution, energy without injustice." "We were a small group moving a small amount of water with solar today," declared Wally Johns with Black Mesa Water Coalition. However, if the political willpower of the Obama administration and the SRP were to follow and transition NGS to solar, all Americans would have reliable water and power without pollution and without injustice. The demonstration was not only symbolic, the reservation needs the water they were collecting. While this Navajo community lives within the shadow of the Navajo Generating Station, the largest coal-powered plant in the western United States, many on the reservation do not have running water or electricity, and they're forced to make the drive to the canal to gather water for cooking and cleaning. This is despite the fact that the plant, owned by the Salt River Project and the U.S. Department of Interior, pumps electricity throughout Arizona, Nevada, and California. Yet the reservation gets just one thing from the power plant: pollution. The plant is one of the largest sources of harmful nitrogen oxide emissions in the country, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. While the plant profiteers argue it brings jobs to the area, plant workers describe harrowing work conditions. "We are the sweatshop workers for the state of Arizona," declared Navajo tribe member Marshall Johnson. "We are the mine workers, and we are the ones that must work even harder so the rest of you don't have to." These problems were not limited to this Navajo community. Crystal Tubols from Lame Deer, Missouri, who came to Arizona to participate in the action, explained, "We're also fighting coal extraction that is right next to our reservation, which is directly depleting our water source." The action marked the kickoff to the National Our Power campaign under the banner of Climate Justice Alliance, which unites almost 40 U.S.-based organizations rooted in indigenous African-American, Latino, Asian, Pacific Islander, and working-class white communities to fight for a transition to a just, climate-friendly economy. And we got this from earthfirstnews.wordpress.com. And GMO beet crops have been torched in Oregon on this article cross-posted from the Political Blind Spot. Though the controlled corporate media apparatus is suppressing the story, 40 tons of GMO crops were torched, prompting an FBI investigation. There has been a complete media blackout outside of local circles, has dared to mention it, perhaps because government fears that if the public learns that other people are getting fighting mad, literally, they might join in and become an actual revolution. It was only reported locally live on KXL Radio and echoed by the Oregonian, where the only website mention of the action exists, except for the earthfirstnews.wordpress.com. It's hard to find because the headline wording is carefully avoids the most likely keywords for a search. Here's what happened. 40 tons of GMO, that's genetically modified organism sugar beets, were set ablaze in eastern Oregon. 40 tons, the entire acreage of two full fields of crops in the ground, were set ablaze over a three-night period of time. That means arson. Evidence is that 6,500 plants were destroyed by hand, one plant at a time. That in turn implies a lot of people were involved. Would you want to stick around once a fire was going and wait to be discovered? No, someone, maybe many someones, probably wanted to move as quickly as possible. We are talking about a movement, a kind of organized revolt. And this is exactly the kind of retribution that many have warned was coming. When lawmakers and corporations refuse to honor the Constitution and instead engage in legalized criminal acts, such as are enabled by the Monsanto Protection Act. More than a decade ago, environmental saboteurs vandalized experimental crops across the country in a revolt against high-tech agriculture. Foes of genetic engineering also struck in 2000 when members of the Earth Liberation Front, with roots in Oregon, set fire to agriculture offices at Michigan State University. The ELF's position was that genetic engineering was one of the many threats to the natural world as we know it. But Earth Liberation Front cells normally come forward immediately to claim responsibility because to them, it's all about publicity to educate the public. Since there has been no statement about the recent arson in the beet fields, this may have been simply Oregon farmers who have said enough. Another clue that may be the case is that this comes on the heels of Japan's rejection of the entire Oregon wheat crop for the year, a tremendous financial blow, because over 80% of Oregon wheat is exported, because one report said one field was contaminated with at least one GMO plant, and so the Japanese didn't want to buy any of it. The rightful fear is because of pollination processes, once you introduce a GMO crop of a given variety anywhere, wind and insects will spread its genetic contamination to non-GMO fields and thereby ruin the entire industry for a region. In fact, Oregon farmers have tended a multi-billion dollar class action lawsuit against Monsanto, joining a long list of states to do so. Monsanto has experimented with GMO crops before they were approved in 16 states. They were supposedly all destroyed, but state after state is finding out the hard way that once Pandora's box has been deliberately left open, GMOs go everywhere. But while other governments in Europe and elsewhere are passing laws to ban GMO crops and burning entire crops themselves in America, our government is passing laws protecting Monsanto from legal repercussions, and therefore it seems farmers are forced to burn the crops themselves. This means where in other countries citizens are being protected from corporate crimes, in America, citizens are forced to become terrorists to survive. That's how blatantly corrupt our corporate police state has become, I'm afraid. In this case, both fields belong to the same corporate agricultural giant known for embracing GMOs, though trying to do so quietly, another reason perhaps big media has kept the story from reaching the internet. We're talking about Syngenta. Nowhere on their Syngenta's U.S. website will you find any mention of GMOs, but that is exactly what the company is all about. They have even lied publicly in writing on this issue with a public declaration. Yet their very corporate name shouts GMO. And we found this at theearthfirstnews.wordpress.com. And fracking equipment has been set ablaze in Elsipogtog, New Brunswick. Try and say that fast. Halifax Media Co-op reports that a piece of drilling equipment was set ablaze on June 24th by person or persons unknown. This comes amidst escalating resistance to hydraulic fracturing by indigenous peoples in Elsipogtog, New Brunswick. This comes after numerous direct actions, the midnight seizure of drilling equipment, and a local man being struck by a contractor's vehicle. Sounds like things are heating up, so to speak, in New Brunswick. Once again, earthfirstnews.wordpress.com. And Australia and Japan are in court battling over whaling. In this story by Thomas Eskret, additional reporting by Alistair Doyle in Oslo, Lincoln Feast in Sydney, editing by Sarah Webb and Alison Williams of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Australia will try to persuade judges that Japan's scientific whaling program is commercial whaling in disguise in a case between the countries that opened recently in The Hague. Japan introduced scientific whaling to skirt a commercial whaling ban under a 1986 moratorium. It argues it has the right to monitor the whale's impact on its fishing industry. But Australia, which filed its case at the International Court of Justice in 2010, says Japan's scientific program in the Southern Ocean is just a cover for commercial whaling. More than 10,000 whales have been killed as a result of Japan's so-called scientific whaling program since the moratorium commenced in the 1980s, Mark Dreyfus, Australia's Attorney General, told reporters this week. What we want to do is stop whaling, and we say that Japan's whaling program is in breach of its international obligations, added Dreyfus, who will represent Australia's open arguments in court next Wednesday. Japanese diplomat Noriyuki Shikata said the Japanese whale research program yielded essential information about the age distribution and proportion of males to females in the Antarctic whale population, helping them decide if stocks were recovering. There are about 515,000 minke whales in the Antarctic, and Japan's research is taking only about 815 a year, Shikata said. This is below the reproductive rate and very sustainable. Nonetheless, environmental campaigners condemned the practice. Commercial whaling, whether conducted openly or under the guise of science, is a cruel and outdated practice which produces no science of value, said Patrick Ramage, director of the whales program at the International Fund of Animal Welfare in London. All necessary research on these whales can be done by non-lethal means, said John Frizzell, a whales campaigner at Greenpeace. However, neither group is involved in that court case. Both countries have agreed to be bound by the court's ruling. Japan's court filings are not yet public. While Australia has many backers, New Zealand has also filed a brief in support of its case. Support for a complete whaling ban is not unanimous. Norway, which never agreed to the whaling moratorium, continues to whale commercially and has declined to intervene in the case, however. Its fisheries minister, Lisbeth Berg-Hansen, has told Parliament it was up to Japan to decide how it wanted to conduct research into whales. And Paiute cutthroat trout restoration begins this summer. A project to restore one of the rarest trout species in America to a remote stream in Alpine County, California, will begin this August. The Paiute Cutthroat Trout Restoration Project is a joint effort of the U.S. Forest Service, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The agencies are working together to restore this rare species to 11 miles of stream on the Silver King Creek and three of its tributaries in the Carson Iceberg Wilderness. The Paiute cutthroat trout, Oncorhynchus clarkii selenarus, was listed as endangered in 1965, and it was reclassified as threatened in 1975. The objective of this project is to recover and reestablish Paiute cutthroat trout in its small historic range and to prevent additional hybridization with other trout species. This is a critical step to conserving the species and restoring it to a level that will allow it to be removed from protection under the Endangered Species Act. If you'd like more information, go to www.dfg.ca.gov. And Friend of the River has sued to stop the Delta Water Plan. Friends of the River, along with several other environmental groups, filed a lawsuit on June 14th against the Delta Stewardship Council for its approval of the Delta Plan. The Delta Plan endorses new water delivery conveyances and storage and paves the way for approval of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. The BDCP includes a proposal to build two 35-mile-long tunnels to siphon water away from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and San Francisco Bay to send to Southern California. The $25 billion project would have devastating impacts on the region's farming and fishing and put several endangered species at increased risk of extinction. The 2009 Delta Reform Act required the Council to create the Delta Plan as a framework for its permitting authority over actions affecting the Delta. According to the Act, the Council must approve only actions that serve the co-equal goals of environmental protection and water supply reliability. Instead, the Council approved a plan that excludes temporary water transfers from the permitting requirements and lays the groundwork for the Delta water export tunnels. The lawsuit filed in San Francisco Superior Court on behalf of groups from both Southern and Northern California asserts that the Delta Plan violates the 2009 Delta Reform Act, the California Environmental Quality Act, and the State Administrative Procedures Act. The groups seek to have the Delta Plan and its environmental impact report set aside for failing to disclose and analyzing the devastating effects of the plan on Northern California rivers, the Delta, and endangered fish species. The lawsuit urges the court to suspend any activity based on the plan that could change the physical environment until the council has met its legal requirements. This would include delaying construction of the Brown administration's proposed water export tunnels. Bob Wright, senior counsel for Friends of the River, said, "Seeking relief from the courts is now necessary to protect our rivers and fish from this arbitrary destructive action. The council's plan is part of the worst threat to Northern California rivers in history and continues state agencies' efforts to take the water regardless of adverse consequences. The Delta Plan calls for the Delta water tunnels with one hand. But on the other hand, the Delta Stewardship Council violated the California Environmental Quality Act by failing to disclose and analyzing the devastating effects adverse environmental quality on Northern California rivers, the Delta, and endangered species of fish resulting from taking of enormous quantities of fresh water out of the Sacramento River upstream from the Delta." And if you want more information about Friends of the River or the Delta Plan, go to www.for.org. And a federal appeals court has rejected an attempt to halt historic species agreement. A federal appeals court recently rejected yet another attempt by the Safari Club International to derail an agreement secured by the Center for Biological Diversity to get protection decisions for 757 plants and animals around the country. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia denied a challenge by the hunting group in January. The group asked for another hearing on the agreement, but on recently that request was also denied. So far, the 757 species agreement reached in 2011 has yielded Endangered Species Act protection for 56 animals and plants, including Miami blue butterflies, Coqui Llanero frogs, the Ozark hellbenders, and another 96 have been proposed for protection, including American wolverines, Austin blind salamanders, and streaked horned larks. Recently, protections were proposed for Sierra Nevada yellow-legged frogs and Yosemite toads, along with more than 2 million acres of protected habitat for these rare mountain-dwelling animals. And the National Rifle Association is ignorant of the basic facts about lead ammunition's effects on condors. In response to an unusual request from the National Rifle Association for information on how lead ammunition poisoned endangered California condors, the Center for Biological Diversity sent a letter recently to the gun group head honcho Wayne LaPierre. Although the NRA has lobbied aggressively for years to stop efforts to get toxic lead out of hunting ammunition, its letter to the center betrayed zero knowledge of the actual effects of said lead on said wildlife. The NRA's letter seemed to reveal ignorance of recent lead deaths, the source and mechanisms of lead poisoning in condors, the magnitude of the lead poisoning threat, the status of reintroduced condor populations, and causes of mortality for reintroduced condors, all of which information is publicly available and published on website of agencies and organizations affiliated with the Federal California Condor Recovery Program. Instead of spending millions of dollars to game the political system, maybe it's time for the NRA to invest some scientific expertise on lead poisoning. Perhaps they're suffering from lead poisoning. Who knows? One tiny snail, another big recovery. Look for the very latest evidence the Endangered Species Act works. Look no further than Logan County, Arkansas, wherein dwells a tiny snail called the Magazine Mountain Shagreen. And yes, that's its real name. The snail, found only in the high rocky slopes of the eponymous mountain, was protected under the Act in 1989 because of threats from a proposed military training activities and recreational development for a state park. Life-saving steps were then taken to protect the mountain snail's habitat and monitor its health. Recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced the shagreen has recovered and is being removed from the endangered species list, the first invertebrate ever declared recovered under the Act. Earlier this year, the agency proposed to declare California's island night lizard recovered also. And a rare bat is closer to California protection. In response to a Center for Biological Diversity petition, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has announced that Townsend big-eared bats, insect-eating and highly sensitive creatures, may warrant protection under the state of California's Endangered Species Act. Whether the bat is actually protected is now up to the state's Fish and Game Commission, which is expected to decide in June. Well, try and figure out whether that happened. Townsend big-eared bats like to munch on moths and roost in caves and have recently declined sharply. Although California hasn't yet encountered white nose syndrome, a disease moving westward across the country that's killed nearly 7 million bats, the epidemic certainly poses a threat along with habitat destruction and roost site disturbance. These and other bats provide a valuable service for California farmers by eating millions of insects that would otherwise attack crops, said our endangered species director, Noah Greenwald. They need our care if they're going to survive and keep providing these valuable services. 5 years after listing, polar bears are still on thin ice. Does that mean their icebergs are tilting? Well, let's read on. 5 years ago, polar bears were protected under the Endangered Species Act. It was an epic victory following years of tenacious work by the Center for Biological Diversity. But our new analysis finds that polar bears continue to face a difficult future as global warming worsens, sea ice disappears, and the government apparatus meant to protect these magnificent bears shows itself largely indifferent to their fate. In our new report, On Thin Ice, sets out 5 crucial steps needed to ensure polar bears have a future. These include upgrading the bear's status from threatened to endangered, aggressively cutting greenhouse pollution, reducing short-lived pollutants like methane and black carbon, and protecting Arctic habitat from oil and gas drilling. Scientists predict that without help, more than 2/3 of the world's polar bears will be gone by 2050, including all polar bears in Alaska. We have launched a new lawsuit to get more protection for these great bears of the North. And a victory for wild Florida endangered manatees. Big thanks to the center's dedicated supporters in Florida who can claim partial credit for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' decision to deny a permit to a destructive dredging project in the Tampa Bay area that would have needlessly harmed 4 acres of wetlands and 29 acres of important seagrass habitat. The center and allies had generated 40,000 signatures opposed to the damaging SunWest development and the Corps denial of the permit, which is said to be contrary to the public interest for a host of environmental, economic, and safety reasons. We'll spare seagrass beds that provide nurseries for fish, shellfish, crustaceans, and a bayou that supports endangered manatees and other unique Florida species. Thanks to the hard, honest work of dedicated scientists and government employees, Philemon's Bayou will remain a prized gem of Pasco County, and dolphins and manatees will continue to thrive in its water, said the center's St. Petersburg-based attorney, Jackie Lopez. And a rare Alaskan seal has moved closer to protection. The only freshwater seals in the United States, Alaska's Illyamna Lake seals are a step closer to protection under the Endangered Species Act. The Center for Biological Diversity petitioned for their protection last year because of the serious threats they face from climate change and a proposed mine. The seals live in the eastern half of Alaska's biggest, deepest lake and in a pristine wilderness that's home to the world's largest run of sockeye salmon. Although scientists are still researching the animals, recent evidence suggests they're a distinct population of Pacific harbor seals. Climate change and acidification threaten these seldom-studied seals and the salmon they depend on, partly through a reduction in the salmon's own food, plankton. And the proposed pebble mine, just 17 miles upstream from one of the seals' favorite haul-out spots, would pollute the water, destroy salmon spawning habitat, and disturb seals when raising pups. In response to our petition, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association just decided to conduct an in-depth analysis of the seals to decide whether to protect them under the Endangered Species Act. And here's news of the wild and weird. The mystery of the narwhal unicorn solved by a dentist. The so-called unicorn horns, once prized by Renaissance collectors and thought to have magical powers, likely belong not to mythical white horses, but to the chunky, odd-looking whales we know as narwhals, which are now among the marine mammals threatened by climate change in the far north. Narwhals are hunted by the Inuit, polar bears, and orcas, and mostly live in Canada and western Greenland. Narwhal's long, single tusk, it turns out, is in fact an 8-foot-long spiral tooth whose evolutionary mysteries have baffled scientists for decades. Now Martin Nguyen of the Harvard School of Dental Medicine has discovered that the narwhal's extraordinarily-looking megatooth actually contains 10 million hypersensitive nerve connections, which can suss out changes in water temperature, water pressure, and particle gradients, helping the animals navigate and hunt. In other words, these unicorn horns do have magical properties after all. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock and then rebroadcast here on Free Radio Santa Cruz on Fridays at 3 o'clock. You can also hear a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update on Radio Free Moscow, KRFP, in Moscow, Idaho. 92.5 FM on Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. And you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. Search for Earth First Update. Don't forget the exclamation point. And download or listen to the podcast there.